is that.
Betsy wasn't on the floor this morning, so I don't know if she was coming.
She said she was going to be out today.
Here, you got to tell me about it.
Good afternoon, everyone. Today is the 21st of February, and this is the Subcommittee on Transportation and Economic Development. I see we've got a quorum, and I'm going to go ahead and call to order this meeting. Senator Johnson did indicate she had a conflict today. She is excused. I think that we'll be seeing Representative Nierman momentarily.
He's sick.
Well, that's no excuse. Most of us have been sick the last 2 weeks. But that doesn't necessarily need to be recorded for the record, but maybe I'm too late to say something. All right, well, look, rather than get myself into even more trouble, I'm going to go ahead and open the public hearing on Senate Bill 5512. And colleagues, as you know, we rotate analysts through the different budgets as they come forward. I think this is the first time Mr. Stainer's been able to join us here in TED. So I welcome you today and invite you to give us a little background on 5512 and the proceedings that are before us this week.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair, members of the Subcommittee. Yes, this is my first time in with you this year. Unfortunately, I think it's going to be my only time until we get to the work session on this agency. But thank you for having me. And what we're doing today, we're having public hearings on Senate Bill 5512. We're going to have 2 days of public tests or public hearings where the agency is going to be presenting their budget and their operations. And then on Thursday, there'll be some time if the agency needs some more presentation time. But predominantly that will be reserved for public testimony on the agency's budget. So just an introduction, in OLIS you have all of the meeting materials and includes the agency's presentation, the CFO presentation, the governor's budget, and a LFO budget review. And inside the budget review from our office, I've highlighted a few items dealing with the agency at the current service level, including the consolidation of the Finance and Corporate Securities Insurance Division, the movement of the SHIBA, or Senior Health Insurance Benefit Assistance Program, from the Insurance Division into the Marketplace Division. We've got some increase in revenues transfers to BOLI for dealing with some workers' comp discrimination cases. And then from the policy side, the agency's got four policy packages of note. One of them is to expand or continue funding for the COFA Islander insurance program. The other one is a expansion of the Oregon OSHA program, pretty substantial expansion of that. And then there's two policy option packages dealing with pending legislation, both Senate Bill 96 and 98, I believe. And which have this companion legislation that the agency may have a fiscal impact in implementing. So with that, I'll turn it over to Pat Allen, the agency director.
Excellent. Well, thank you for that introduction, Mr. Stainer. And Mr. Allen, I see you've already come forward. So if you'd like to introduce yourself for the record, we'd be very pleased to hear from you.
Thank you very much, Chair Gomberg, members of the committee. My name is Patrick Allen. I'm the director of the Department of Consumer and Business Services, and we're delighted to spend the next couple of days here discussing our program and our budget with you. Mr. Stainer already kind of gave you the quick version of the program. Today we'll focus on an overview of the agency and our financial structure. Tomorrow we'll have brief presentations from our various program areas to go in a little bit more detail. It's also where we'll talk in more detail about the policy option packages that we have proposed. And then if there's any lingering questions or material to cover, we'll do that on the third day. But as Mr. Stainer says, reserve that for public testimony. The agency's mission, as we showed on the first slide, we're the state's primary and largest consumer protection and business regulatory agency. Our mission is to protect and serve Oregon's consumers and workers while supporting a positive business climate in the state. And I want to linger there for just a moment because there are, in our minds, sort of two halves to that mission, the protect and serve element and then the positive business climate element. And when we think about a positive business climate, what really motivates a large chunk of what we do is the notion that thriving markets in Oregon for insurance products, for banking services, for construction activities, for all the things that we regulate, strong markets with multiple players who are competing for consumers' business is itself a strong consumer protection tool. The best way you can protect yourself as a consumer is to take your business to someone who treats you better than someone who's not treating you well. And so we really think about how do we make sure that our markets protect people but are also attractive to businesses so that we've got that vigorous competition within the marketplace. When we think about what we do, as an agency, primarily we are the state's main financial services regulator. We operate the state's worker safety system, which is worker safety and health through Oregon OSHA, as well as the workers' compensation system that deals with problems that occur when someone does get injured on the job. We set the state's construction standards through the Building Codes Division, and courtesy of you all about 18 months ago, we now operate the state's health insurance marketplace. Those are kind of the very broad functions, and we'll come and talk about those in some details. But I wanted to kind of give you the overall general picture. If we think about our goals, what is it that we're trying to accomplish in operating these programs? I won't read this list aloud to you, but a couple of things just to simply focus on. Consumer and worker protection, healthy competitive markets. I just talked about that in terms of our mission. Informed businesses and consumers is important to us because, again, people being armed with what they need to know to be able to make informed choices is one of the primary ways that consumers can protect themselves. And then I want to touch on financial soundness just briefly. That has a dual meaning for us. It's the financial soundness of the operations of the agency itself, but it's also the financial soundness of many of the entities that we regulate. When you think about our regulatory activity with respect to banks, credit unions, insurance companies, a big part of what we're trying to do there is make sure that those entities are being operated in a financially safe and sound way so that they're around to be able to pay claims or make good on deposits. If you strip away all the organizational structure kinds of things, though, and think functionally about what we do, there are really three things that regardless of what industry we're regulating, our work devolves into, and those are licensing, educating, and setting standards. And I'll take just a minute to speak to each of those. We have a bunch of phrases that statute uses that is some version of giving an entity or an individual permission to do business. It can be a license, a certification, a charter, a whole bunch of things that you've placed in statute, but it's the general notion that a business or individual comes to us, they demonstrate some sort of initial threshold qualifications, we provide them a license, and then they're subject to some kind of ongoing behavior requirements, how they have to operate, records they have to keep varies considerably from entity to entity. But the idea is that we provide that license, we oversee that conduct, and we have the ability to suspend or revoke that license as a tool to encourage good behavior. We set and enforce standards. Now, I just kind of touched on that a little bit in terms of licensing with standards that you have to operate by. And it ranges from fairly simple stuff like using permits, but pulling permits if you're an electrical contractor, up to the standards that you have to follow to be chartered as a bank or to be able to have a certificate of authority as an insurance company. The standards that we operate, though, also include things like the state building code. Oregon is unique in most states in that we have a single standard statewide building code that applies to all cities, all counties across the state, and it's our agency that sets that code. Building code itself is a bit of a misnomer in that what there are really are a series of codes, a plumbing code, an electrical code, and so on. But our job is to set those standards, and then we license local jurisdictions through a delegation of authority to operate about 135 different local building programs that issue permits and check plans and do inspections and those kinds of things. And then the last area is education and advocacy. And that ranges from work that our staff do in seminars in partnership with organizations like AARP to help senior citizens be aware of common scams that are in the marketplace that they deal with, to the advocate function that we have through our hotline for people who have issues with insurance companies where they can get some assistance advocating on their behalf to try to resolve questions or problems that they're dealing with. It also applies to the work that we do in the health insurance marketplace, both with respect to the Affordable Care Act and that care, as well as the Senior Health Insurance Benefit Assistance Program that Mr. Stainer touched on, where we help senior citizens navigate the Medicare system and how they figure out what coverage they should be getting and how they make use of that coverage. All right, so that's a kind of a bit of a functional, what are the tools that we use or what are the ways that we approach our work? I want to talk now a little bit about how we're structured. And before I really get to that, I want to kind of walk you through a historical structure of the agency for just a second, because I think it's kind of illustrative of how we've tried to look at how we organize ourselves to do our work. This is the agency's org chart circa about 2003. There are 12 different business units there, and it's a reasonably dense structure. And the next three slides that I'm just going to quickly blow through show, as different units have been assigned elsewhere or eliminated, we were able to simplify our structure. We then, when I started as director, consolidated multiple divisions within the agency that were providing internal services, IT, financial services, and those kinds of things, into a single central services division. Mr. Stainer touched on about a year old implementation of a single division of financial regulation that replaced two parallel divisions that dealt with insurance and finance and corporate securities, but have very similar functions. And so that gets you to the structure that we have today with the addition of the health insurance marketplace. And in that structure, we have eight units, so about a third fewer business units serving, I don't know, 15% more Oregonians over that same period of time. And so we've tried to pay attention to how we organize ourselves to do our work, to make it the most effective way to do our work, but also to impose the least amount of organizational overhead on top of the work we do. Each of those boxes tends to have a management structure that goes with it, and we're able to slim that down as we simplify the organization. So starting with that organizational chart, I want to take one more cut at how you can think about and divide the work that we do. Historically, the agency is actually about a 25-year-old merger of several independent agencies, and so thinking about how we work across those historic organizational lines is an important part of how we try to make sure we're as effective as we can be at doing our work. Worker safety is a topic that touches on two divisions and one independent unit within the agency. Oregon OSHA on the primary prevention side for worker health and safety, the workers' compensation division for what happens after someone gets hurt or sick on the job, how they get medical treatment, how they get wage replacement, what happens if they're disabled, all those kinds of things. And then the Workers' Compensation Board, which is independently appointed by the governor, confirmed by the Senate, but is a part of our agency for administrative purposes, that adjudicates disputes that are within that worker safety system. But multiple functions across different parts of the agency. Similarly, consumer protection touches on our Division of Financial Regulation primarily, but also the Building Codes Division, where we're really concerned about things like construction defects and other ways that people get value out of construction they do, and what's the process that they're able to resolve disputes around code requirements and those kinds of things. And then the health insurance marketplace, both with the Affordable Care Act and with the Senior Health Insurance Benefit Assistance Program, to help people make informed decisions about the kinds of insurance coverage they need and issues that come up in that. And then building safety, similarly, hits a couple of different organizational structures. Obviously, the Building Codes Division, where we're setting the standards, licensing the skilled construction trades people who do that work. But all of what they operate is an at-construction standard. How does it have to be built? Oregon OSHA, in cases that touch on workers, cares about how buildings are maintained and operated. So they've got an ongoing standard that they look at in terms of the safety of buildings with respect to workers. I also want to take this opportunity to touch on one other thing that sometimes is confusing, and I don't recall whether you have the Construction Contractors Board budget or not, but that's actually a different organization completely that we've got some partnership with, but they're the ones who regulate contractors and building contracting and those kinds of things, and that's a separate function from what we do. That tends to be a little bit confusing at times. So that's sort of, in very brief, what is it we do? How do we think about our work? What are the tools that we use to do our work, and how have we organized ourselves to accomplish those missions? Let me touch on a couple of things that are some questions that you have asked us. In terms of agency-sponsored bills, we have a rather robust set of bills that looked like a good idea a year or so ago when we had to start building this list. There are five concepts around worker safety, that have to do with some really arcane details within the workers' compensation system around medical arbiter panels and some of those kinds of issues. There are also, however, there's a bill that improves worker compensation benefits in the case of permanent total disability. We have a bill that improves and streamlines benefits in the case of the death of workers, and this really is dealing with the survivors of deceased workers. It simplifies calculations that are required for children who are going on to college, also simplifies calculations for payments of goodwill to children, and gets rid of some arcane stuff that have to do with the living circumstances of the surviving parent, and the benefits could vary for historical reasons that really don't track with how the system works today. And we'll talk about the next one more tomorrow. But the federal government changed its penalty structure for OSHA penalties and applied an inflation adjustment for the first time in a couple of decades, which resulted in about an 85% or 89% increase in federal maximum OSHA penalties. And we're required under federal law to maintain penalties that are that correspond to federal penalties. And so we have a bill that raises our maximum penalties and also provides the ability for us to adjust them as the federal system now indexes to inflation going forward. Really important point to make about that is these are maximum penalties, not the penalties we actually assess. Oregon is one of, if not the lowest state in the country for actual penalties assessed. We think that in combination with the vigorous presence on work sites is more effective in driving down workplace injuries, and would expect to continue to do that.
Excuse me, Director Allen. Senator Hansel, you had a question?
Yeah, I just had a quick question. I believe we heard Senate Bill 92 in the workforce yesterday. Are all of these bills moving at this point? Have they been having hearings? Do you know where they are in the process?
All of those bills are moving. Yeah, I'm just looking. The workers' comp bills have all been heard in on the House side. I believe the medical arbiter panels bill has already been worked. I think the benefit improvements and death benefits are scheduled to be worked later this week. You've heard at least Senate Bill 92. I believe you've heard 93 and 94 as well. Yeah, all of those have been heard. The self-insurance streamlining bill has been heard and I believe worked on the House side. And then we have the second page of bills that I haven't touched on yet, but I believe those bills generally are moving, other than two of the health care bills that were kind of slow rolling, pending learning as much as we can about what's going to change at the federal level. Mm-hmm.
Please continue.
Let me just touch briefly then on those bills. We have bills on the, as I said, the Senate, House Bill 2341 and 42, which really have to do with how the Oregon health care laws line up with federal health care laws. As you know, that system is in turmoil, and we're holding those bills as long as we can to be as nimble as we can to federal changes and see what develops out of that. On the consumer protection side, we have a collection of bills. Balance billing is the circumstance where you go to a hospital for surgery, you're at an in-network hospital, your surgeon is in-network, you've gotten everything pre-approved, and it turns out that the typically where this happens is something like the anesthesiologist or the radiologist turns out to have been out of network, and you end up, after you're done, having thought you did everything you needed to do it right, to get a large bill for whatever wasn't covered by your insurance company. This is a bill that tries to address that, applies some uniform standards so that those services that typically result in balance billing, which most often are anesthesiology, radiology, and emergency physician services, are covered at standard rates and don't result in that kind of a balanced billing circumstance.
Senator Hansel.
If you need a live example of that and why that bill would be needed, I would volunteer for it.
I appreciate knowing that.
Because it happened to me.
It's unbelievably common. That's right. Quickly on the other consumer protection bills, Senate Bill 95 is a bill that deals with creating a category of mandatory reporting for financial abuse of seniors for financial advisors, so that if they become aware of a circumstance where there's a scam going on, where there's money being pulled out of accounts or those kinds of things, they report that to Department of Human Services. Senate Bill 96 has to do with financial safety and I'm going to skip Senate Bill 96 because I think I'm about to say something that's not accurate, so I'll come back to that. Senate Bill 97, Insurance Corporate Governance, is applying some NAIC model standards to basically arm's-length board oversight of insurance companies. And then Senate Bill 98 is loan servicers. We've got a gap in our regulatory coverage of loan servicers right now. If a state-chartered financial institution, a bank or credit union, is servicing loans, they're covered by us by virtue of their state financial institution charter. If a national bank is doing business in Oregon, they're covered by the federal government. There's a category of business that's not covered at all, that's just a standalone loan servicer, and we've got a number of them in the state, and they are a center of a fairly significant degree of consumer complaints about the kinds of things that you heard during the mortgage crisis around misapplication of payments, losing paperwork on renegotiations of mortgages, all those sorts of things. This gives us the ability to license those folks and regulate them outright, which we don't currently have. That's our package of legislation. I'd like to turn now to a financial overview of the agency. You've asked us about our budget and environmental drivers, and I would say it's a good question and an interesting one in an economic time such as this. Ordinarily, we're driven because all of our revenue comes from fees on those we regulate, and we regulate things like construction and insurance and banking. Ordinarily, our financial drivers are the same financial drivers as the economy overall. So in an ordinary situation, if we're coming into a session where there's a big budget gap, that usually means the economy's performing poorly, and so we would be having budget pressure as well. This is really kind of unusual in that there's a big budget gap this session, but our underlying financial fundamentals are really quite strong, with at or above average performance in all those sectors that we regulate. So we really don't have difficult financial pressures on us right now. We do have a lot of uncertainty in the federal health care legislative environment. I was just back last week with Lynn Saxton from the Health Authority and Jeremy Vandehey from the Governor's Office, meeting with our delegation and some key committee staff to try to gain clarity on what's going to happen at the federal level, and we didn't come back with any clarity gained, I guess I would say. The challenge for us and for you all is that it appears that it's going to be unlikely that we'll get much clarity much before you all have adjourned. And so one of the things we're going to have to deal with and that we're engaging with the healthcare committees in both chambers right now is what kind of regulatory flexibility do you all want to provide us to be able to deal with changes that occur after you've gone, when we don't have the ability to come in for new legislation again until February. In your materials, I think in an appendix, there is the prioritized list of services, and what you see on the screen now is simply the general principles that we use when we prioritize those services, and really it kind of goes along the lines of physical health and safety of people is the number one priority. Financial health and safety of people is the second priority. Programs that deal with lots of people are more important than programs that deal with a few people, and so on through that list. That's the general approach that we took to constructing what our prioritized list of services is. Jumping ahead, there's a slide later on where we talk about our proposed cut scenarios. And this is shocking, I know, but we applied the exact reverse of the process, and so to come up with our cut list, we started at the bottom of our prioritized list and cut from the bottom up until we got to the 15% that we were required to, because we think that list of priorities is the right list of priorities, whether you're starting at the top and working your way down or starting at the bottom and working your way up. Our financial structure as an agency is pretty complicated. We are almost entirely other funds, with the exception of a new program, again, that Mr. Stainer mentioned, the insurance support program for COFA Islanders, and I'll come back to that a little bit later. We have 30 different statutorily dedicated funds that we account for, discrete from our other funding sources. We have 500 different statutorily dedicated fees, assessments, charges, and we basically account for and track all that stuff. It makes for a fairly complicated accounting structure, but it's one that we're used to dealing with and have for a long while. We have some federal funds, primarily through Oregon OSHA. It's a federal matching program that Oregon overmatches, and so that's our largest source of federal funds. We do have some federal grants that are small in the Division of Financial Regulation related to the Affordable Care Act around things like insurance rate review and mental health parity and those kinds of things. Those are very small dollar amounts in the big scheme of things. We generate about $151 million for the general fund, largely through charges on securities as well as what's called the insurance retaliatory tax. That's a tool that states use to equalize taxes across states so there's not a tax advantage to a insurance company doing that wants to sell insurance in Oregon to locate either in Oregon or its home state. That actually generates most of that $151 million. The bottom line of our budget is the bottom line, which is it's a 1% increase over the 2015-17 legislatively adopted budget. That consists of about a 12% increase at the continuing service level and then various puts and takes across policy packages and adjustments and recommendations, as well as e-board and special session changes. The biggest driver of what's the difference between 15-17 and 17-19 were the financial inflows and outflows related to our absorbing the former Cover Oregon. That involved some financial transactions that had to do with software systems that were on contracts with Cover Oregon that became DCBS contracts but were really being used by the Oregon Health Authority until they brought up their new eligibility system. So they reimbursed us a fairly significant amount of money for those contracts, but we were the paying source, and so you see some fairly significant fluctuations in our budget as a result of that. They're now off of those systems, and so you see those dollar amounts coming back out of the budget, and it all nets to a fairly flat budget. I'm just going to quickly run through our policy option packages because we're going to mostly tomorrow talk about those when we get into the program by program discussions. But we have our biggest pop is workplace presence. This is basically how many boots on the ground do we have in worker health and safety inspections and consultations. Our rate of being able to be present in businesses has eroded significantly over about the last 15 years. We'll show you some data on that. This is an attempt to not reverse that erosion, but to stabilize it. We then have small impacts related to a couple of our bills. Those are the bottom two pops on financial advisors and loan servicers. And then we have a pop. You created the COFA program mid-session last year. This is the pop that makes that position a permanent position as part of our budget, but it doesn't represent an increase over what's currently being done to operate that program. And again, we'll come back and talk about those in more detail. You've asked us to talk a little bit about what we've done in the way of administrative efficiencies in the agency. There are many things. I want to just touch on a few examples. We've already talked about briefly about the creation of the Division of Financial Regulation. Let me spend another minute on that. Previously, we had an insurance division that regulated insurance companies and a division of finance and corporate securities that regulated banks, credit unions, mortgage lenders, and a variety of other small programs. At their core, however, what both divisions were doing were assessing the safety and soundness of the financial institutions that were operating programs, checking them for compliance with various statutes around consumer protection, responding to complaints that they were mishandling claims or dealing with depositors illegally or in some cases engaging in fraud. The functions themselves were pretty similar. It was simply the type of charter that varied across those divisions. And so we really took a top-to-bottom look at our work and realized that those charter-based organizational divisions were inhibiting our ability to effectively work across those charter lines to more effectively do our work. An example that we're dealing with right now comes out of the insurance area, where we're looking at whether companies are complying with statutory mandates to treat mental health insurance requirements the same as physical health insurance requirements, and bringing in fresh eyes out of our former finance and corporate securities investigation area into a merged investigative team has given us all kinds of benefits in terms of our ability to look at that activity and be able to make some findings and begin to do some regulatory work that we'd not been doing as aggressively before as we could have. That's an example of the kind of benefit that we think we're getting out of that merger. We've moved our payroll services from doing our own to having DAS payroll do them. That's a couple of people worth of FTE, so it's not a ton of money or anything like that, but there's just no reason for us to spend time in our agency doing something that DAS is perfectly capable of doing. And it's one more thing in sort of our central services area we don't have to think about, because we know that that's being done and taken care of for us there. We've implemented a performance management system that in particular involves really being much more thoughtful than we have before about the kinds of things that we're measuring and how we're assessing our performance. And we're going to come back to that when I talk about key performance measures, because we're now proposing to change some of our longstanding key performance measures that we've been reporting to you dutifully and we've been counting and paying attention to, but we haven't really been using to manage the organization. And we're proposing to substitute some of those for things that we actually pay attention to and use to make management decisions in the agency. We've had a significant project around reducing our office space. We've actually freed up about 10,000 square feet in the Labor and Industries building that involved shrinking individual footprints to something that's much more in line with commercial standards for standard office space. But we've also done that in a way where we've moved lots of people out of private offices, created lots of more individual quiet workspaces, conference spaces, those kinds of things, and really tried to create a modern working environment, but in a way that uses much less space than we did before. And we believe our space utilization is now in line with federal GSA and other and private sector standards. And that space is available for DAS to, well, at the end of the biennium, be available for DAS to allocate to other tenants. And then we participated in the enterprise-wide email consolidation. If you were around here, 10 years ago, you'd hear a question asked a lot of times, why does the state have 53 different email systems? Well, ours was one of them. Department of Administrative Services led a project that consolidated 10,000 users onto a single email system that's operated by Enterprise Technology Services. And again, it's not something that results in tons of money that I don't spend, because I have to pay them for the email system just like I was paying to operate it myself. But that's one less thing, again, that our technology people have to worry about or pay attention to, and we're able to devote those resources in ways that are more effective.
So, excuse me, Director Allen, I'm going to interrupt you at this point and ask a question related to both financing and efficiencies. Mm-hmm. And you and I have talked about delinquent debt, uncollected monies within the agencies. And if I'm not mistaken, in 2014, you were reporting about $50 million in uncollected debt. In 2015, it was again in the $50 million range. I haven't seen the current numbers, so
$57 million.
$57 million for 2016?
Yeah.
So trending up a little bit there. Could you talk to the committee just a little bit about what those numbers represent and
sure.
what we're doing to try and bring the numbers down rather than see them inch up?
Sure. So let me take those in reverse order. We've implemented a new protocol for how we deal with debt. Largely, we had been collecting in-house all of our debt. We continue to do that until our debt is a year old, then we turn it over to the Department of Revenue. After they work it for a year, they turn it back to us, and then we turn it over to private collection agencies. And so we've tried to regularize that process in a way that we had not before. What our uncollected debt is really kind of part of the story of why that dollar amount sits there. I'm working from some somewhat later numbers where the dollar amount has come back down again to about $52 million. But of the $52 million as of a couple of days ago, about $31 million of that is out of the Workers' Compensation Division, and the large majority of that comes from what we call non-complying employers. These are people who got caught without having workers' compensation insurance and a claim got filed. And the way the law works is if you have a claim filed against you and you didn't have workers' comp insurance, you're on the hook for all of it. The business and the principals are responsible to pay the medical claims, the indemnity payments if someone becomes disabled, they're on the hook for the dollar amount for the rest of their life. That's a supplement that makes up for their economic losses. And you have not given, you have, I think, rightfully not given us statutory authority to waive or reduce those dollar amounts. If you got caught trying to be a free rider on the system, you're stuck with that pretty much forever. Interestingly, that also represents the single largest source of calls from legislators to us asking why we're trying to collect this money from people, because you end up with stories of someone who's gone out of business and or was a spouse, or, you know, just all kinds of horrible things. But that's the system that is intended to discourage people from trying to let those who are buying workers' comp insurance carry them and not have insurance. The other large portion of that debt is from our Division of Financial Regulation. Of the $51 million, it's about $19 million. There, what we do often is it's in the area of civil penalties. And we regulate lots of fine, upstanding businesses that sometimes make mistakes and run afoul of statutes and those kinds of things. But we also, using usually securities law, regulate people who are just running scams. And when we catch somebody running a Ponzi scheme or some version of a Nigerian letter or whatever, we will often assess a civil penalty that's shockingly high. $1 million is not unusual. The idea is not that we think we're going to collect $1 million from someone who's a scammer. Frankly, the idea is we want the next person who they run across some years from now, when they're up and running again, to Google them and to find our $1 million fine as one of the first searches, and hopefully that's a piece of information that that sticks to them. And that's another source of constituent calls we often get, are people wanting us to scrub our records to get that stuff off of an internet search so that it doesn't stick to them. But that's the idea. And so there's money that we're putting in there that we know is uncollectible, and it's because we're collecting it really isn't the point. It's the tag that we're trying to associate with that person.
And I understand and appreciate that. So you slap a symbolic, if I could use that phrase informally, a symbolic fine on a scamming company, mm-hmm. an allegedly scamming company. Is that carried forward the same way that other debt is? Do you put it on your books for a year, send it over to Revenue? Revenue sends it back to you. Mm-hmm. You send it out to a collection agency?
Yeah, and we do actually try to collect that money. I don't want to suggest that we're not trying to get it, but we're being realistic about our chances of getting that money.
Do you have any sense for us of this $51 million? How dated this money gets? I mean, is a third of it fresh? Is a third of it more than 5 years old? And if you don't have that at your fingertips, I'd be happy to give you a little latitude to come back to us.
Well, give me a moment, because I may have it at my fingertips, but I may not be able to read fast enough to give you that answer. So I think we'll bring you back an aging that can give you that sense.
And I'm also interested in the collection agencies we work for, because the reports that I've looked at suggest that a lot of times we're using in-state agencies, a lot of times we're using out-of-state agencies. We're having different levels of success with different agencies we're using. Do you have any indication for us where this debt is being shopped out to?
Yeah, no, what I'll do is bring you back an aging and some indication of the agencies that we've been using as we've moved to the system, and give you a sense of that.
All right.
Chair?
I'm sorry, Representative Mink.
Thank you, sir. Quick question on the compliance of who ensures that employers are carrying that workers' comp insurance. Is mm-hmm. that your department?
Yes, it is.
What are the type of tools that, because I know having a big claim like that is going to cost us more.
Right. So we do an auditing function where we receive reports from insurance companies when they drop policies. And so we do follow-up and matching to see that the coverage has been reinstated somewhere else, or do follow-up to find out what happened to the coverage. We do auditing of businesses to make sure they've got coverage. And then we use the claims system and other reporting tools to identify companies that aren't in compliance.
So just quick follow-up, sir.
Please.
Thank you, Chair. Well, what do you think the percentage is of non-compliance right now?
It's 2%.
2%?
2% of filed claims are filed against businesses that turn out not to have had workers' comp insurance. So I would say our system is actually really pretty successful in terms of assuring that people have coverage. I think that's probably quite a bit higher than the system for making sure people have car insurance when they're out driving.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair.
Other questions? One more question on delinquent debt. What kind of interest rates are we applying to these bills?
They're statutory interest rates. I don't know that number off the top of my head.
Very good. All right. Well, we'll look forward to getting a little more feedback from you in writing rather than make you dig into your documentation right now. But please know this committee is most interested in $50 million that's owed to the state by Oregonians and what we're doing to try and get some of it back.
Absolutely.
Thank you.
All right, just quickly, a couple of graphics in terms of our financial structure again. And we're going to use a couple of different terms that mean a couple of different things, and I want to make sure you're up to speed with that. This represents our total available revenue, which is the revenue we expect to take in, plus the fund balances that we have and some other things that are fairly minor in terms of transfers. We think of the agency as having an operating side and a non-operating side. The non-operating side generally translates to non-limited funds that are related to the worker benefit fund that have to do largely with providing adjustments to workers' benefits over time as wage rates and inflation rates go up. And that's not part of our operating budget. The right-hand side of this graph is part of our operating budget, but that dollar amount includes all of our sources, including our fund balances. This, then, is the actual operating budget of the agency that doesn't consider those fund balances, at least not in the same way. This is the actual revenue that that runs the agency and where it comes from. And so you can see that the two largest chunks are what's called the premium assessment. It's a tax on workers' compensation premiums that we establish and collect that pays for those three parts of the org chart that I showed you that were the worker safety system, Oregon OSHA, Workers' Comp Division, Workers' Comp Board. That blue piece of the pie pays for that system, and it's through the workers' comp insurance system. The red chunk looks like one big chunk. It's actually a whole bunch of little chunks that are those 300, most of those 300 different fees and assessments that are statutorily established and run across lots of different industries. There are some larger pieces in there that are assessments that we do in insurance and banking and credit unions that are asset or premium based, where we figure out basically how big is the industry and we have an assessment across that dollar amount that pays for those industries. And then everything else is relatively small in terms of interest earned on fund balances, federal funds, which I indicated flow mainly through Oregon OSHA. And then we're talking about fines. I'd point out that fines is actually a fairly small slice of what we charge in terms of civil penalties. We're having a conversation about the increasing the maximum fines for Oregon OSHA, and what always goes with that conversation is, well, isn't that just an incentive to go try to get fines? If it's an incentive, I'd say it's not a very good one because it's a pretty small part of our overall budget. So this is looking at the same thing, but in terms of what do we spend the money on? And you can see that there's really not any overly dominant part of the agency. Oregon OSHA is the largest piece, but the Division of Financial Regulation, Workers' Comp Division are also fairly sizable. Our smallest function is the Health Insurance Marketplace. And, of course, that's having inherited Cover Oregon, but not having inherited a technology system. And so that's really people who are working to help get people signed up with insurance. We're not operating a big, expensive technology platform to go with that. Speaking of technology, you've asked us what technology projects we have in the pipeline, and the short answer is for 2017-19, we do not have any technology projects that trip over the stage gate levels through the Chief Information Office. We are in the very early business requirements information gathering stage of a project that we may be coming to you in 2019-21 to replace our workers' compensation claims information system. This is a legacy system, parts of which are in excess of 30 years old, that is essentially the backbone of the system we use to manage the workers' compensation system. Now, to be sure, we don't pay claims at our agency. The carriers pay claims. But we gather data on every claim that forms the backbone that we use to assess the effectiveness of the companies in paying claims, and it also assesses the risk of industries and businesses so that we can target our resources on the Oregon OSHA side better to those work sites that are more likely to result in workplace injury and sickness. And so this is a system that is effectively end of life. We are still able to make modifications and updates to it, but they get more and more difficult. The ability of companies to report data to us gets more and more difficult. When we move forward on this project, the challenge is going to be a version of a saying I've heard is, once you've seen one state's workers' compensation system, you've seen one state's workers' compensation system. They're really all different. There's not an off-the-shelf market for this kind of stuff. And so it's the kind of thing that is going to need to be built to meet Oregon's business needs. That'll inherently be a reasonably high-risk project, and of course we're treating it as such. And as I said, we're really at the very beginning stages of not even getting to the first stage gate yet, doing information gathering of what that project will look like when it becomes timely for us to bring that forward.
Representative Reardon.
Time to confess my ignorance. I don't know what stage gate means.
Oh, I'm sorry. The Chief Information Office operates an approval system that has got what they call stage gates. There are four different points where you bring a project to them, and there are requirements that you have to meet in terms of readiness to move on to the next stage of dealing with that project.
Used to call them phases.
Okay. Well, their emphasis is on the gate, not the stage, I think is the point.
Good move.
I already talked about the fact that we used the inverse of the prioritized services list to come up with our 15% reduction list, and that's in your appendix. Quickly, the changes from the agency current services level budget that you see in the governor's budget. I talked about the puts and takes related to the marketplace, the fact that we've got technology investments that have expired on that side, and the litigation that was that we inherited. Bringing Cover Oregon in has now been settled, and so there are changes related to technology budgets, transfers to the health authority, DOJ bills, those kinds of things. And then there are small changes related to the issues I already talked about transferring our payroll, the governor's executive order consolidating security, and those kinds of very small changes. So largely the outside of the marketplace adjustments, the governor's budget is not significantly different from the current services level budget. excuse me. Long-term vacancies, we have about 36 of them out of 930 odd positions, so we think of that as a fairly low level. About a dozen are filled or currently in recruitment, and then there are a variety of circumstances with the others. About 16 of those are actually less than 12-month vacancies. And being another funds agency, a vacant position means we're not spending money, as opposed to in a general fund agency where a vacancy means money's been given for that position and is sitting there or being used otherwise. The last part in the agency overview that I'd like to talk about is key performance measures, and I'm going to do this just a little differently than our presentation overhead. I'm going to talk about the proposed changes as we go through these measures. Excuse me. This is just kind of the quick dashboard level notion. We have 14 key performance measures that we report to you. To be green, it needs to be within 5 percentage points of its target. And you can see that about 3/4 of our measures are at that level. 3 more are within 6 to 15 percentage points of target. And we have one performance measure that's more than 15 percentage points off of its target. And we'll talk about that when we get to that one. So generally, I guess I would say a favorable overall characterization of where we stand on our performance measures. The first two measures are measures I'm going to talk about that we propose to replace, because we don't think they're as effective as some other measures would be in terms of trying to track our performance. The first has to do with the performance of financial service entities. And it's basically looking at the regulatory rating of financial service entities. Now, what you find in all of these is often the title sounds like something that's kind of interesting, that's not nearly as interesting as what we're actually measuring. And what we're actually measuring here is a fairly narrow slice of regulated entities and whether they meet a particular regulatory threshold. What we propose to replace it with is a much more comprehensive measure across all of the industries that we regulate, and use examination results for all those entities that we examine, that we turn into a basically an index measure that is broader than the four entities that we measure in our current key performance measure. We think the performance itself will be similar, and it's unfortunate that Senator Johnson's here because she just wanted to make sure we weren't trying to weasel out of measures that we weren't achieving, and you can see as we're currently defining it. And yes, weasel was her word. As we currently define it, we, other than coming out of the recession, have not had a challenge in meeting this performance measure. We think it's just not broad enough, and we want to broaden it with our proposed new measure. Insurance consumer relief is a measure that ostensibly looks at complaints and tries to find how often when someone complained did we provide them relief in terms of monetary relief with an insurance company. This is a measure that's defined for us by the National Association of Insurance Commissioners, and virtually every single word in that measure is counterintuitive as they have defined it. It's not just complaints, it's confirmed complaints. It's not a resolution. It's relief. Relief isn't always financial. This measure, again, it's one that we generally do a pretty good job of meeting our target on, but it really is a very small subset of the work that we do in our insurance advocacy program. I'll give you an example. Someone calls in and their issue is that their car has been totaled and they don't like the value that it's been totaled for. We can do things that would show up. Well, first of all, if the company followed their contract and they dealt with that appropriately, there's not a confirmed complaint there for us to get a recovery on. But we can call the company and say, hey, could you take another look at this valuation and see if you guys think you got it right? And they'll often look and, you know, figure out that they can improve the value on the total. Now, was that because they really got it wrong the first time, or was it because a few hundred dollars of improved value is the right thing for them to do as a business in terms of consumer goodwill? Well, you know, we don't try to parse that out and figure that out. This measure kind of almost makes it look like we do. Similarly, we'll get a call from a consumer that's got some kind of an issue with their policy, and the answer is, sorry, Mr. or Ms. Consumer, you're actually wrong. The policy says what the company says it says, and you're not entitled to money. And we usually do that in a way where lots of times we're able to get to the consumer where they understand their policy and they're not upset with their company any longer. Sometimes it doesn't work out that way, but that doesn't show up as anything here, even though we got that situation resolved for the consumer. So we're proposing to basically replace this measure with a responsiveness measure that we think does a better job of tracking how we're doing. And it's really fairly simple, and it's our performance in meeting a time standard for how quickly did we whatever resolution was, how quickly did we get that resolution for the consumer. And so we'll set a target for that and a time frame. But the idea is to get quickly back with a final answer and not try to parse out what that final answer is here as this measure does.
Chair?
Yes.
Representative?
Related to that, mm-hmm. I mean, it says helping consumers resolve their complaints. What type of, parameters are you given to help resolve these complaints? It's just, I'm just curious to what the standard is set for you at resolving this.
Well, so if the company has violated the insurance code or violated the terms of the insurance contract, we have the ability to enforce that. And require the company to follow the law or make good on the contract. That ignores the broad category of resolutions where that hasn't happened, but there's still a dispute, and we're essentially doing dispute resolution and getting the consumer to a place where they agree. They may not, you know, they may not be 100% thrilled, or maybe they are, but they agree that their situation has been resolved.
Yeah, thank you, Chair. Follow up. Yes, because it seems like the tool would be that, I think that what they're trying to solve is that if they have a, you know, they feel like they're being abused, that you let them know, yes, you are, or you're not, you know,
right.
But not necessarily resolving the complaint. It's, or even, you know, getting to a point that they understand their policy. So how would your measurement change just as quickly as you can let them know what
Yeah, it would be how quickly do we get to it?
You've looked at it and you say, hey, it's not an issue, but do you have a great valid claim? Is that?
Yeah, how quickly do we get to the finish line for that claim? Versus this measure that sort of assumes that our job is to get money for people, which sometimes is the case and sometimes isn't the case, and we sort of lose that whole second piece in the way we currently construct this.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair.
Representative Bearden.
Thank you, Chair. I was also curious about the measures because somebody else was presenting last week said something in a similar fashion that made it sound like, well, 75%, that's okay. So under the, which I've never worked in an organization where 75% was okay. So with the new and improved system, what would your outcome be? What would your expected outcome be? What do you think would, you know, is good marks?
I would expect that number would be quite high. I would think that we would be shooting for a number in the 90 to 95% range of meeting a set timeline to be able to get to a resolution. That would need to be the nature. This number is quite a bit lower because not every confirmed complaint results in bad behavior by an insurance company. Mm-hmm. Confirmed complaint means that, yeah, if what you say happened, that's against the law, but that doesn't get into did it actually happen that way, and that's why that number needs to be a little bit lower because not everybody who complains has a valid beef, effectively. Does that make sense?
Follow-up?
Yeah. So, and I'm not trying to belabor this or beat you up about it. Honestly, I'm not. I'm just trying to get my head into this. So I'm thinking that 100% is when everything goes right, spot on. And so in the case that you were talking about, we resolved the issue in X amount of time. Our standard was all complaints handled in 3 days or less, make something up. So mm-hmm. in that case, wouldn't your goal to be 100%, not 90 to 95? Otherwise, I mean, it sounds like your real mark is less than 100.
Yeah,
less than
Chair Gomber, Rep. Bearden, as a manager, I'm loath to ever want to say my performance that I'm going to be held accountable to is 100%, just because things happen. We've got measures where we do track like to 98%, those kinds of things. I think it needs to be a very, very high measure. I would seldom think that a hundred percent is appropriate as the target that I want to shoot to operate for. It's probably not appropriate as the performance measure that I want to be held accountable to delivering month in and month out, just because of the things that happen that can't be accounted for in ordinary operations.
One more.
I should just be quiet, but we should go have a cup of coffee or something. But would you want your car manufactured to 90, 95%?
Or no, I'd want it manufactured to Six Sigma, which is not 100%.
Yeah. Okay. We should have coffee.
Okay.
All right.
You good?
Thank you.
Representative Meek.
Thank you, Chair. And this is just channeling the good spirit of Senator Johnson. We just want to make sure you don't sandbag out there. So.
Right. Yes, I appreciate
that. No sandbagging.
All right, let's talk about one that we're not going to change.
Before you go, Senator Hansel.
Back on that, even if it seems to me that you can get, you reach your goal, whether or not it's resolved to the person's satisfaction. If you say that you don't have a case or whatever, that's the reason. You've resolved it, have you not? Mm-hmm. Doesn't that fit into it?
Not into the measure we currently have, but it would into the measure that we propose.
Okay.
Any other questions? Okay.
I'll move on to measure 3, which we don't propose to change, and this is one where a number that's below the target is actually good, because this is the occupational injury and illness incident rates. And so our target, as you can see, is for Oregon workers to be safer over time, and our performance tracks that we've managed to be able to perform at that rate. Measure 4 has to do with workers' compensation insurance, providing benefits timely. There are statutory standards for how quickly they need to do things like get a first check out the door, get claims paid, and those kinds of things. This is something that we audit for when we audit workers' comp insurance companies. And again, you can see that our performance is at is at about target. Representative Rudin's point about not quite at 100% notwithstanding.
Thank you.
Measure 5 is very similar. It's an accuracy standard. You would probably note 2014 represented a fairly significant dip. We think that that's an anomaly because this measure, it deals with who we actually audited, not the entire universe of everybody, and we think we basically, one way to look at it is we audited the right people because we've audited companies that weren't performing very well, but we believe that number is an anomalous occurrence. Number 6 and 7 are measures, again, that we propose to change, and these are super arcane measures that deal with a program that we have that's a return-to-work program that focuses on something really important, which is getting people who are injured back on the job. The faster someone goes back to work after an injury, the better their outcomes for everything else are in terms of staying employed and income and those kinds of things. This measure measures the performance of people who use the return-to-work program versus people who don't use the return-to-work program. We're proposing to replace that with a measure that simply compares injured workers to those who did not have disabling injuries. So we basically want to look, forget about whether someone participated in a program or not. If people got hurt on the job in Oregon, how is their performance over time, regardless of which programs they do or don't use or what resources we apply or don't apply? We'll then use that data to do things like refine our programs and target them better and adjust them. But we want to look at the overall population of injured workers because we think that's more meaningful than the slice of them that use our return to work programs. This is reemployment. Yeah. The next measure is wage recovery. Same population using the return to work program. What percentage do they fall short? This one is interesting and kind of helps illustrate why this is such an oddball measure. People who use our return to work programs have worse economic outcomes than people who don't use our return to work programs. Well, does that mean that our programs are causing them to lose, have lower income? No, probably they're harder to resolve cases that are using our programs. But it kind of indicates that we're probably looking at not quite the right thing with this measure, and the larger population of injured workers continues to be what we think is the right measure to look at. We already talked about this number, and this is another one where being below the line is good. This is the percentage of workers' comp claims filed by individuals whose employers turn out not to have workers' comp insurance. And you can see that for the last 3 years, we've been down around the 2% level. So 98% of claims are filed by people whose employer has workers' compensation insurance. We think that's a very good outcome. And then measure 9 is one that we...
If you could return to that slide for a minute.
Sure.
So in the last 10 years, we're making significant progress. What do we attribute that to?
Well, couple of things. I think it's the auditing programs that we use to try to get out and match, do data matching with companies that have dropped their coverage and matching them up with where their new coverage is. We think we've probably done some more work with making more of a public splash about big assessments against companies that are repeat offenders or persistent offenders at not having workers' compensation insurance. There's probably some economic effect in there, although it's a little bit hard to suss out. But it's a combination of all those things. Also, workers' comp rates have been coming down persistently through this entire period, including a 7% decrease in workers' comp rates just this past year. So the product itself is getting more and more affordable, and so the cost benefit for an individual business to look at whether they want to try to go bare or not, I think, is continuing to improve.
Yeah, but a 50% reduction in a 10-year period is not inconsequential. Okay.
Right.
Very good.
This is another measure that doesn't quite do what it would indicate that it does. This is not the percentage of workers' compensation companies that are meeting standards. This is the percentage of companies that we look at that meet standards. Hopefully, we're not spending lots of time looking at well-run companies that are meeting standards, and we're spending more time looking at companies that we've got concerns about that aren't meeting standards, which kind of runs at cross-purposes to trying to drive a number up. So we think that we have other information. You saw some of the measures earlier as well as other things that are not key performance measures but are operational measures we use that adequately get at this concept without using this, what we think is a misleading measure, as one of our key performance measures. And so there's not a proposed replacement for this one. This would simply be a reduction from our fairly lengthy list of 14 measures. The next measure is a measure of the Workers' Compensation Board. It basically is when they get appealed to the Court of Appeals, how often did they get it right? That's actually less straightforward to calculate than you might think for a couple of reasons. One is it's not uncommon for a workers' comp decision from the Court of Appeals to consider five issues and say we uphold on these three and we overturn on those two. How do you deal with that? Lately, the Court of Appeals has also been willing to effectively make brand new law with its decisions in workers' comp. And so, you know, if the standard was, did the workers' comp board make the right decision based on the way the law was before that Court of Appeals decision, then yeah, they made it. If the Court of Appeals really changes the understanding of the law, that counts as not a measure. For all that, their uphold rate has historically trended around 80 to 90%, and so they're upheld a large percentage of the time. This is we've got a couple of measures then that track electronic business. This is in the Workers' Compensation Division, a program that uses what we call minor labels to do permitted work that effectively get permitted in bulk. So water heaters is the best example. A company that does water heater installations will buy basically a sheet of permits from us. This is the number of those kinds of sheets that get sold. When they get used, it gets reported to us. We let the jurisdiction where it got used know about it. And then a small percentage of those are inspected on the back end to make sure they did the right work quality. That replaced a system that existed before where every time you did a water heater, you had to go to City Hall, get a permit, go do the water heater. Someone from City Hall came down and did an inspection. Very cumbersome for very little safety benefit. This system applies a much more, we think, effective percentage audit kind of a system to that and automates it through online sales. And our target here has generally been to increase that over time. This one clearly shows an economic effect in 2008-09 when the construction industry effectively collapsed and the volume of those permits dropped. We're back on a strong increase track.
Chair?
Sorry. Yes, Representative Meek.
Thank you, Chair. Question about that. Do you think that with the influx of folks moving into the state and the number of houses or, you know, units in the state, that you may adjust that number up?
The target?
Yeah,
you know, we've not looked at that target in a while. Candidly, this is a measure that I would not be surprised to see us come back and propose to eliminate or replace with something different in the future. This measure was created when this program was brand new. We really wanted to use the measure to drive activity that direction, and that's kind of run its course. So I think rather than reset the target, it's likely we'd come back to swap it out for something different.
Thank you, Chair. That's a good program.
This is a composite measure of timeliness of work in the agency that's made up of literally dozens of different functions that we have, and their timeliness, an example, is how long it takes us to turn around a license for an insurance producer so that they can get out and start selling insurance. Last one is, again, an electronic transaction or an e-commerce kind of a measure, and this is the percentage of transactions that get completed electronically. You can see we're now up over 60% of our transactions. We try to be a little cautious about how hard we drive this one, because the easiest way to drive it would be to say the only way you can do business with us is online and get rid of, you know, all paper business. And there are private sector businesses out there that do operate that way, but we're sensitive to the fact that we operate in rural communities of poverty with limited internet access, a whole bunch of different things that mean, I think, for what we do, for the foreseeable future, there's always going to be an element of in-person and via paper that our customers are going to prefer. But we continue to make good progress in trying to do more of that business electronically, which meets lots of needs and tends to be cheaper. And then the last measure is our required customer service survey standards. And this is the stuff that you should be seeing from all agencies around the standard survey questions and methodology. And we blast these surveys out to large numbers of folks. I do want to point out that we do things like survey businesses that just had an OSHA inspection shortly after they were inspected to ask how satisfied they were with the inspection. And even in that kind of a circumstance, get good marks from folks that they may not have liked the fact that there was a citation or whatever, but that they were dealt with accurately and helpful, and the person had good expertise in those factors that we measure in that customer satisfaction survey. And I think I've really already covered the notion that we're beginning to want to change our performance measures to line up with our performance management system, and those are the proposed changes that we talked about as we went.
Sure.
And that?
Yes, Representative.
Thank you. I just wanted to commend you on taking a look at your performance measures to make sure they actually line up with what you hope to achieve in your business. After working in government and dealing with performance measures and knowing that you can easily just put this out here without actually having it impact your day-to-day business and how you provide service is extremely commendable. And it's a risk, understand, because to truly be a performance measure, you need to set goals that you would strive to reach, and then be realistic and be willing to evaluate that year to year, and even maybe change the targets as you start to achieve them.
Chair Gomberg, Representative Noble, I appreciate that, and I appreciate your acknowledging it's a risk. it is kind of when I talked about the minor label performance measure that kind of in between the lines is, depending on how this goes, we may be back next time with more proposed changes. That concludes our agency overview portion. We can either wrap up a little bit early, answer other questions that you have, or we could actually move into our worker safety program area if you'd like.
Let me start with this. Colleagues, any questions? Yes, Representative Bearden.
If two. Been talking to a number of agencies lately, and can you give me some idea of the age of the computer system that you're working with? If you can't, that's fine.
So computer system would be a misnomer. It's a variety of systems.
Yeah.
We have, and so we're all over the map. We are dependent on core systems delivered by Department of Administrative Services, finance and budgeting and personnel and those kinds of things that tend to be similar to the workers' comp system, 30 to 40 years old, written in Fortran and COBOL and kinds of things where the programmers are going off to do other things, hopefully. All the way up to systems that we rely on, particularly in financial services, where they're nationally delivered systems that we participate in and which are modern, often cloud-based applications that others are responsible for the care and feeding of, and we participate in them usually through fees that are assessed on those who work with them. In between the two, the one that we're probably the proudest of is our online electronic building permit system, which we began rolling out about 9 years ago. Now we signed the contract with the vendor. It's a cloud-based vendor-delivered system that's the first of its kind in the nation that allows filing building permits for any jurisdiction, any participating jurisdiction, and there are a lot of them in the state. You're able to electronically submit your plans. You're able to check the status of your plan review, get your permits, schedule inspections, and all those kinds of things. And that's a state of the art system.
Great. The second question.
There've been certain changes at the federal level lately that, and you skipped over Senate Bill 96 dealing with financial planning, and I believe there's some changes at the federal level to loosen up the requirements on financial advisors. So when that sort of thing happens at the federal level, are you in a position to suggest greater protections for Oregonians here?
Chair Gomberg, Representative Reardon, very much. Through the implementation of the Affordable Care Act, what we tended to do in Oregon was change state law to track with and match federal law, or in places where they needed to be complementary. If federal standards, however, go away, you all will have the opportunity to revisit those questions, and in some places it'll be impossible to maintain standards that went with that if the federal standard has gone away, but there'll be other places where you may make a decision, and this isn't just in healthcare, it's, you know, worker safety standards, financial regulation. You'll have the opportunity to make an objective decision of, do you want to track with a new federal standard, however it changes, or do you want to maintain a state standard?
Okay, great. Thank you. Glad mm-hmm. you're there.
Other questions? Well, Director Allen, I think your next section is somewhat lengthy, and we've just got about 10, 12 minutes left, so I think what we'll go ahead and do is hold that till tomorrow. I am loath to turn six legislators loose in this building with free time on their hands for fear that they'll be wandering the hallways like elected zombies, but be that as it may, I'm going to go ahead and close the public hearing. And do we have anything else we need to cover before I close today?
Not after that.
Anything from any of the members?
Not after that.
All right. Then I'm going to go ahead and adjourn this meeting. We will reconvene tomorrow. Thank you.
Thank you.